Okay, it's what is it? Wednesday, the 13th of February, 2013. Here with our, it looks like my annual late winter walk with Jim Dimitri, and we're stopped right here at the Sarcococca. This is like one of the very first signs of spring.
Yeah,
this is a Japanese plant. Yes.
Yeah, I think these grow throughout Asia, I think the Sarcococca confusa. Ruscifolia and Confusa are two that you commonly see. One has red berries, and the other primarily has black berries. But this plant is it's related to the boxwood, and it's just got such an amazing fragrance. And the flowers are very discreet looking. So, you know, sometimes people think that the more fragrant a plant is, the larger the flower.
No,
might be.
It doesn't work that way.
But here we've got And these can grow like to be about 6 feet tall. So I think they cut these back every few years. I have one of these growing outside of my kitchen door, which I find very very nice when I'm taking the garbage out in the winter to have this scent.
Yeah, and how would you describe this scent? You know, I take from like sommeliers and people who deal with tea and that, and they said it has a nice woody smell, or it has a nice sort of apple finish. But how would you describe this?
Well, I think it has you know, it's funny, one of the names for it is a sweet box, and I would say it is sweet, and maybe has not quite in the realm of, say, vanilla sweet, but it does have a kind of rich sweet complexity to it that I think what I find with a lot of these winter plants is that their scents are not things that have been quantified in a way that it's very hard to liken them to particular scents that we're familiar with, either in terms of things that we eat or some of the more common perfumes, the Chanel No. 5, whatever it is. I think there's a whole host of different scents here that we're going to be encountering. Some remind me of like warm spices. Some have kind of a citrus quality to them. But this one is just very pure. And again, very hard for me to describe it. But
you know, it reminds me of Sam Hamill when we go in for coffee, and they said, "Do you want any flavor in that?" He said, "I want it to be coffee flavored." So this smells like Sarcococca, you could say. But the berries are black and shiny. And is there any use for them at all? Or,
you know, I've tasted them before, and I'm biting into them now. They're quite kind of nondescript. You know, slightly sweet, but not really. In possession of the kind of qualities that I don't think they're poisonous. I know boxwood, I think, is poisonous.
You don't think they're poisonous after I put it in my mouth?
Well, no, I do. I have tasted just about all of these things. Maybe not ingested them so much. But
and it has small seeds in them.
Small seeds, and it is slightly sweet, but not in a way that, you know, would make it kind of desirable for the table.
Yeah.
But anyway, the thing I like about these, they can grow in almost complete shade. I never water mine all summer, and you'd never know the difference.
What is it about a plant that decides it's going to bloom at the beginning or middle of February? How do plants develop the genetics like that?
I think part of it is I think evolution dictates when a plant will do its thing for reasons of
survival.
Yeah, like maybe this is the optimal time for pollinization because of some qualities that the weather might manifest. Just it's really hard to say. We'll see some pollinators here. We're going to see some Anna's hummingbirds. I'm almost certain. And they're doing a lot of that. But again, a lot of these are also wind pollinated. And we might, it's too early for any kind of bees to be out and about. But we'll see some of the California hazelnuts, which are beaked hazelnut, our native hazelnut. and you already see the catkins coming down. And again, those are pollinated by some early wind. But I think it, you know, it is part of the natural selection process. Plants, you know, they adopt certain qualities that allow them to reproduce and survive, you know, certain climactic conditions. And you know, it often means kind of staggering of whatever flowers, fruit, leafing out. These are evergreen, which is another thing I like about them. The Northwest is a fantastic place because we have so many broadleaf evergreen mm-hmm. plants because of our kind of mild climate.
Now, one last question about this. So this is not native to the Northwest.
That's correct.
And so when did the process of it coming here begin? Has it been around for 20 years, 30 years, or is it 100 years, or did it come with the Japanese settlers of the, you know, early 1900s?
You know, this is a very interesting question. I'm not sure who the botanist or explorer was who kind of brought this into cultivation in the West. My guess, it might have been an Englishman you know, because again, all these plants had been cultivated in China, and the Japanese had you know, done, and Koreans too, they have their own, you know, ancient horticulture traditions. But most of what came to the West came via certain botanists who might have traveled with explorers. And I just don't know when these might have arrived. Well, but one interesting fact, since we're on that subject, because the first explorers to, you know, come through here from Europe and kind of examine our native plants were British, like Douglas, of whom the Douglas fir is named, and the Douglas squirrel. They brought a lot of these plants back to England, and what you find is that in the English horticulture tradition, you see a lot of Northwest native plants that you might seldom find on the East Coast or in other parts of America. You know, whether it's our red flowering currant or the Port Orchard cedar, a lot of those were brought back to England and kind of became part of their horticulture world. And, you know, lots of varieties were, you know, created through selective breeding. And they're still, like, very present in the landscape there, and probably more present than they would be in, you know, New York, someplace like that. Also, the climate there is rather different. We're
more conducive to this than the East Coast. Well, so is it fair to say that people in England are more interested in this part of the world than people on the East Coast of the U.S.?
Well, in ways they may not understand. I mean, this, you know, Washington was, you know, kind of part of the, it was a territory that was kind of in dispute between the United States and Britain, because the Hudson Bay Company had settled their claim here. And it wasn't, you know, until very late. I can't remember. I was reading this on History Link recently, that the areas north of the Columbia River were finally kind of established as part of the United States.
That was the Oregon Treaty.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so...
1850s.
The Oregon Treaty of 1830, and then, you know, you had the Pig War, which settled the last bit of dispute once they settled on the 49th parallel. But the Polk administration, or the Polk campaign, ran on the 54-40 fight,
yeah,
which would have taken us all the way to, quote-unquote, Russian America,
yeah,
which is where Alaska, the Alaska Panhandle, starts. But that didn't happen. Can you imagine Vancouver as a U.S. city? But
yeah,
the other thing about that is, William Everson points out in his book Archetype West, is that, you know, the eastern states were all colonies,
yeah,
of England, whereas this part of the world was not a colony. And there were several different claims. You know, yes, the U.S. and the U.K., but also Russia had explorers here, and we bought Alaska from Russia. And Spain
at Nia Bay.
You know, Spain had a claim that went all the way up to Clackwat Sound, and the Nootka Convention started to begin to settle some of this. So it's very interesting.